Hey, this is a dark tangent. Organizer of DEF CON. You're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 3, held July 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1995. Now, the Tropicana has since been renovated. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, all rights reserved, the Dark Tangent, and DEF CON Communications. Permission is expressly granted, though, for educational, non-profit use. If you have any more questions about DEF CON, or want to send me some email about the copyright status, please email me at dt@defcon.org, or the website is www.defcon.org. Now, kick back, get ready for some good speeches, and thanks for supporting it. Pull up the lights again, just part of the lights. Whoever had the lights. 12 minutes of video, so you guys can survive that. At SLP speed, though. You realize this, we're playing on a VCR that until the other day didn't even ever have a case on it. Its drive motors are powered by rubber bands. There's no plate on the bottom of it. And there's no counter. And we clean it with Q-tips. I brought disposable technology because you never know what happens with these things. Like my laptop. It stops bullets, but it doesn't compute. Are you ready?
Support staying off course. 113 miles off course.
Okay. Is that it? It's the Pimp Daddy Dad 0 day VCR.
You see the space shuttle, you're a little before they make it disappear.
I saw that down in the Las Vegas Strip. They made the Sigmund Fried and Roy disappear. Yeah.
The show's producers will be traveling the globe finding the most amazing men and women for next year's World's Greatest Magic. Now, Albert Einstein said that without mystery...
I've got my thumb up my...
There you go.
Oh! The Antichrist. Oh, yeah. Okay, is that it? Is that picture? Okay, bring up the lights for the intro by Edwin.
A cup will do. That's a cup of paper in it, thank you.
Morning, I think. Good afternoon. About 7 years ago, the state of Oregon ran into some trouble.
Oregon, the mic.
Is this mic working? No.
All right, that mic's working. About 7 years ago, the state of Oregon ran into some trouble. Apparently, one night, a 60-foot-long blue whale ended up beached at a very small town. And after a couple of days of it not going back out to sea, hello.
They realized that
now it's working now that I put it down, of course. This is kind of, all right, this is better. They realized that the whale was dying, dead, and the carcass was going to be rotting very shortly. So, in their infinite wisdom, they tried to decide who was going to take care of the problem. So the locals gave it to the local police. Local police didn't know what to do about it. The local police gave it over to the state police. State police didn't quite know what to do with the 60-foot rotting carcass on the beach in the small town in Oregon. So in their infinite wisdom, it ended up back with the legislature, the government. And they decided to assign the problem to the Department of Highways. So the Department of Highways now has to deal with this rotting carcass. They decide, in their infinite wisdom, that the best way to dispose of it is by placing 3,000 pounds of explosives around the base of it and blow it up. At that point, after the explosion, all of the seagulls on the beach would take care of the little tiny remnants and everybody would be happy. The media got a hold of the story and the tourists came for the Sunday morning dawn extravaganza. So they had police lines a couple hundred feet away from this rotting carcass. And the police were there, and the cars were there, and the cameras were there, and the tourists were there, and everybody is waiting for this explosion. At the prescribed time, somebody presses the plunger. And this huge explosion commences. And the crowd goes, ah. Which soon translates to, ugh, as blubber starts spreading over the crowd. Condominium-sized pieces of whale collapse into Volkswagens. The biggest problem is what to do with 700 dead seagulls. Well, obviously, what this story tells us, there's a moral in it somewhere, is that they used the wrong solution for a problem that they knew nothing about. And I think Jim Settle talked a little bit about this, about Congress, referencing what we have up there, the legislature, the people who are not technology savvy. They're really not. Out of the 535, Jim, how many are lawyers? 538. The majority of them have the legal background. They do not have the technology background. And maybe I disagree a little bit with Jim. I think that we need some technologists up there. We don't need the lawyers. So, when we're looking down the road about the dangers, some of the things that Robert Steele was talking about, the ones that Jim was talking about, I think that we need to look a little further into the future. I remember a few years ago, I gave a talk in front of Congress, and it was a hearing about the 1987 Computer Security Act. And I was talking about what I referred to as magnetic weapon systems, HRF guns, high energy radio frequency. Everybody's heard the term HRF? Can everybody say it? Say it again. HRF, it's a nice sound. HRF, you do it well. So I was explaining to this congressional committee about what magnetic weapons were and how they could debilitate computer systems, communication systems, networks, the satellites, power grids, what have you. And after my explanation, Congressman Glickman, he's no longer a congressman, he was the Democrat out of Kansas, the head of the committee, he said, Mr. Schwartow, these HRF guns, they sound like they're mighty dangerous. Yes, sir, they are. He says, do you think we should add them to the Brady Bill? So to get us going now for the next few minutes, everybody remembers who Connie Chung used to be. I have a 12-minute excerpt from whatever the name of her ill-fated show was, but it's an interesting little 12-minute snippet about an issue that concerns magnetic weapons and where I think we're going to be going in the next few years in this area. So if you don't mind, if we could do the lights and hopefully the sound will work. If the people in the back can't hear, use bigger ears. I know they had a sound problem. Let's run the video, dim the lights, about 12 minutes, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Alarm. An airliner's compass mysteriously swings off course. An electric wheelchair spins out of control. What's the connection? We asked Roberta Baskin to investigate this growing high-tech phenomenon, which is scaring even the experts. Roberta?
Connie, whoever thought that you could trigger a hospital emergency by dialing your cell phone? Well, these wireless goodies are loaded with gremlins and can cause mayhem.
We live in a sea of electromagnetic energy. You can't see it, but it's everywhere, and few of us ever stop to consider its consequences. Cellular telephones, CD players, computers, two-way radios, TVs, all emit waves of energy.
like radio waves.
And when the waves collide, for example, when this radio gets too close to this computer, you get electromagnetic interference, EMI.
We ask that you do not use portable electronic devices such as tape players, audio video recorders, or players during catch-speed takeoff and landing.
If you've flown recently, you were probably warned about EMI.
Portable telephones cannot be used at any time on board the aircraft.
Ever wonder why?
We were on a climb out from our departure airport, and the first thing that I saw was a red flag popped up down the lower left-hand corner.
Airline officials don't want to talk about EMI, but Denny Pistol will. For more than 25 years, he's been a pilot for one of the nation's biggest airlines. He was at the controls of a 727 when one after another, the compass, bearing, and distance measuring instruments all failed.
You're talking about losing your navigational equipment.
That's correct. That was exactly what happened, and we lost it on both systems, the primary and the backup, almost instantaneously. If we were in bad weather and dependent on our own navigation, the odds of coming out of that successfully would have been very, very diminished.
You could have crashed.
We could have crashed.
How did you figure out what was going on?
It was about that time that our flight service manager from the cabin came up, and she said, "We have a big problem back here."
The problem was some passengers playing a radio, just a radio.
When they turned the radio off, did your instrumentation come back?
All of the instrumentation restored to back to normal.
Perfectly normal?
Perfectly normal.
There have been more than 100 incidents of electromagnetic interference, EMI, reported by pilots, most anonymously. Several pilots report straying off course, 13 miles off course, and suspects passengers playing electronic games are to blame. Another reports missing his landing approach twice.
When you see it firsthand, it really does make you a believer.
Automakers also are believers. They struggle with such problems as windshield wipers turning on and off, car doors locking, cruise control speeding up, all because of interference. The biggest concern is safeguarding airbags and anti-lock brakes. Chrysler, for example, is spending $20 million at this lab to test and shield cars against EMI.
But some of our most important electronic devices aren't well protected. Hospitals are finding out, often by accident, that interference with medical equipment can be life-threatening.
All the lights came on just like that.
Susan Ill never heard of EMI until it affected her son, Chris. He depends on a ventilator 24 hours a day. But one day, while driving home from the hospital, the ventilator alarm sounded wildly.
The whole machine just went haywire, and we didn't know why.
It wasn't until several months later, when it happened again, that Susan figured out that it was her cell phone that was triggering the problem.
I hung up the phone, and everything went back to normal again. When I take Christopher with me, I do not turn my phone on anymore. Twice is enough for me.
The babies in this intensive care unit also depend on ventilators for every breath. But nurses at Arkansas Children's Hospital got a scare when alarms on all five ventilators went off at once. Immediately, all available staff had to help the babies breathe by hand.
So we'd have to jump up and attend to the patient and make sure they were getting enough oxygen and getting breath.
Nurse Carol Winans was in charge the day the alarm sounded.
It created chaos.
Like this.
We had no idea what it was.
It took 4 days to figure out interference from a shuttle bus radio was the cause. At Indiana St. Margaret Mercy, wireless monitors in the cardiac unit suddenly went haywire. It was tracked down to two-way radios miles away. That interference problem led hospital staff to look for others.
There it goes right now.
Like a cell phone that can cause a ventilator to malfunction. A two-way radio that can shut down this drug infusion pump. And watch how a flip phone can trick this incubator into suddenly heating up without warning. And hospital personnel scrambled at Eastern Maine Medical Center when an alarm for the purified air system was set off by a security guard's two-way radio. A hospital director, Ron Gregory, sent out an alert on his computer bulletin board. There were responses from all over the world.
England,
France, a lot of the United States. In Norway, it is now common that the use of cellular phones are not permitted inside hospital buildings.
I thought, gee, maybe our equipment is affected too.
In New Jersey, emergency medical technician Jan Walitsky got the message and tried an experiment of his own. He turned on his two-way radio near his defibrillator, a critical care device that shocks the heart during cardiac arrest.
Check pulse.
And as you see, the defibrillator told me to check the patient's pulse. It did not charge up the shock.
When he showed the experiment to us, the defibrillator failed about half the time.
It wouldn't have shocked the patient, and the patient who might have been able to be saved would not have been saved.
In fact, the Food and Drug Administration knows of six reported cases where electromagnetic interference is believed to have caused defibrillators to fail. There are more than 100 reported incidents involving all kinds of medical devices, including five suspected deaths.
Manufacturers of these devices are increasingly aware of the potential for problems, and they're doing a considerable amount of research.
And the FDA is also doing research. Dr. Bruce Burlington oversees the testing. Virtually all electronic medical devices are susceptible to interference, but so far the FDA has set standards for only a handful of devices.
We're certainly looking at equipment like respirators, equipment like pacemakers, and equipment like powered wheelchairs, where if something goes wrong, it obviously has potential tremendous impact on the person who's relying on that device.
This is where we were just going up.
You don't have to tell that to Jim Hill. He's a Korean War veteran living just outside of Denver. He took us back to the scene of a wheelchair accident that almost killed him.
What was the first clue that there was something that wasn't quite right?
The clicking noise. Just started making a clicking noise, and all of a sudden the wheelchair just did a completely 180, just like this.
By itself?
Just by itself. And I just took off, and I was just going so fast, and I went...
Right off here?
Right off here.
And how far a drop is that?
I'd say probably 15, 18 feet. The wheelchair tipped like this, then I went down first, and the wheelchair came down, lit on top of my chest, and I just went tumbling down there.
And you were critically injured.
They thought I was dead. I did, too.
You still have real strong memories.
Oh, every night. Nightmares every night. Goes off a cliff.
It's not clear what happened to Jim Hill. It may have been interference from nearby transmission towers or from somewhere else. What is clear is that there have been several cases of wheelchairs spinning out of control, prompting the FDA to conduct its own tests.
That wheelchair is not being controlled any way except by the radio frequency interference from that handheld radio.
The FDA has now told manufacturers to make electric wheelchairs resistant to EMI. Although Jim Hill has a new chair, he's still wary.
No matter how safe they say that they are, I don't think I'll ever have a chest and forget.
It's no wonder Jim Hill is fearful. There's so much that's not known about electromagnetic interference. Except that our greater reliance on electronic devices almost guarantees more problems.
So what's being done? Well, some manufacturers are adding warnings to their product literature. Others are looking for better ways to shield devices from interference, as the car manufacturers have done. But in the meantime, some hospitals, like the airlines, are already banning cell phones. So, Connie, this is something that we're going to be hearing a lot more about.
All right. Thank you, Roberta. Coming up, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood and the littlest star in the...
And computer crimes on the...
Stop at work. Despite that was Connie Chung, it's actually a pretty decent representation of an area that I've gotten more involved in the last couple of years. You'll note that all of the kinds of problems that were being exhibited in Chikani's video were what we call low-level interference, meaning that we're talking milliwatts, 500 milliwatts or 5 milliwatts or just enough milliwattage in the cell phone to cause a sure case of brain damage. Very low-density power transmission out of these devices that are causing this interference. However, in a lot of the incidents that we are projecting are going to come down the line, let's take this issue of low power and multiply it by a factor of 100,000. or a factor of 10 million, and start issuing large amounts of electronic power on the order of a megawatt or 10 megawatts, we need to start considering from a defensive posture, what are we going to do about this? Now, in the world of security that I live in, there's three basic tenets that are the foundation and beliefs in the systems and practices that we work with. The first is that of confidentiality. Confidentiality means keeping secrets a secret. And the way that we deal with that is with good cryptographic systems, good key management systems, adequate management on top of the key management systems, and assuming that the organizations, the government, the private sector, whoever is using these systems are actually going to stay on top of it and use it. We do have the technology to affect confidentiality, either in transmission or in storage. The second opinion of information security is that of integrity, in that the information should not be modified either on purpose or accidentally during transmission, during storage. I mean, nobody in this room would want to have an extra zero added to their bank account accidentally. And banks want to make sure that doesn't happen, so they use integrity modeling, and the solutions are, again, cryptographically based, in that you have the RSA, you have PGP, you have the digital signatures. There's a lot of different types of approaches, but they're all cryptographic in nature. So I maintain, and not everybody in my field agrees with me, I maintain that in principle we have the technology in hand by which to solve the first two major opinions of information security, that of confidentiality and that of integrity. However, the third opinion of information security is what we call availability, meaning that the systems, whatever they are up and running and working. Because if they're not up there working at all, nobody has access to them, and we call that denial of service. And I'm becoming of the belief that denial of service, the removal of the availability of the systems, is a lot more critical because of the nature of the compound problems that we face to solve it. Let's take a look at a little bit of history here. I made some notes. 1990 and 1991. I remember the AT&T and the phone failures nationwide, whether it was an accident, SS7 programming switch software errors, whatever it was a denial of service. Not necessarily a denial of service attack, but a denial of service event. Then can we hypothesize in that one, could somebody have intentionally caused it? That's a question that we need to examine as we continually rely upon computers, communication systems down the line. World Trade Center, February 26, 1993, my mother's 75th birthday, so I know the date. Denial of service. A massive conventional bomb goes off, and what happens to all the computer trading companies and the bonds markets and all the guys that are inside of there? Their power goes down. They have a denial of service. The phone lines go down. There's a denial of service. They're out of business. So what do? They hop across the Hudson River over to Hoboken and go into a ComDisco hot site recovery that they've leased $1,000 a month in preparation for something like this. And within 24 hours, they're back up online. They have recovered from the denial of service event. In that case, it was an attack. And they're back up and flying. But not all of them, because the people that had not taken adequate security precautions did not have the backup facilities to put themselves back into business, and they had to go elsewhere in order to accommodate this. But unfortunately, 3 weeks later, the no-name storm, the great no-name storm of 1993, I live at 6 feet above sea level, and the water came to 5'11" above sea level. It was a long, dark night for us. That storm that affected the Northeast collapsed the roof of a major banking center, collapsing the ability of 7 ATM networks in the Northeast to function. So normally what would happen is that data center would go over to Hoboken, New Jersey, and use ComDiscos or whoever it is, their backup recovery sites. But they were already full from the World Trade Center issue. We had a second denial of service event occur within a three-week period within the same demographic area. So in order to get some of those ATM networks back up online, they had to go back to California, use one of those systems, and route an ATM asynchronous transfer mode network back to the Northeast to start getting them back up and flying. And still, 2 million customers were out of ATM service for almost a month, a denial of service event. I'm suggesting that denial of service is what we need to start looking out for in the future even more. Let's look at Newark Airport just earlier this year. Anybody remember what happened? No, wrong one. Newark Airport, there were some high-paid guys with jackhammers who went through the power lines. The power lines. I don't know, somehow they cut through the power lines and shut down the power to all of Newark Airport. So what do you normally do in that case? You go over to the backup power. Except the designers put the backup piping, the backup wires, in the same conduit. And the high-paid construction workers with the jackhammers went through both wires. And if you recall, Newark Airport was totally shut down for 24 hours. A denial of service event that in that case affected worldwide travel because Newark is an international airport for the finest airline on this planet, Continental. No, I fly on U.S. Scare where it's required two drinks before you get on. Again, a denial of service event and they're out of commission. New York, the other two airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy, they were shut down three times in a seven-week period between April and May. There were two communications outages and one power outage in Queens and Brooklyn, New York, that affected the ability of these airports to be able to operate. Denial of service. The first denial of service event that we could probably, whether it was an attack or not, I guess that's going to be an arguable term, was 1988, November of 1988. Everybody remember that infamous day? Worm, Robert Morris Jr., son of Robert Morris Sr. from the National Security Agency, somehow accidentally on purpose, didn't mean to, but it happened anyway. Worm got out on the Internet, and a lot of the Internet came to a grinding halt. Again, this is a denial of service event. Now, the way that I look at things, and Robert Steele, I don't know if he's still here, he and I talk about this a great deal. We tend to believe now that the majority of the real honest threat to corporations, especially as they migrate to the Internet, and to our country, from a national security standpoint, are not confidentiality or integrity breaches. We just don't see that any longer as being a major, major telephone call. Clueless. We see denial of service as becoming much more of a threat. Now, in Russia, back in the Cold War days, there was not exactly a whole lot of open communication between government and the population. The government was obviously dictatorial, totalitarian. And there wasn't a lot of openness as to what the future of that country, the dialogue didn't exist. And conferences like this and some of the other ones where hackers and the other side, dark side, light side, good guys, feds, whatever, are able to talk to each other. I tend to believe, and I know Robert does and a number of others, we may be able to start getting a handle on a solution to a problem before it becomes a huge problem. Now, earlier on, somebody asked Jim Settle a question about should the government regulate the telecommunications to make sure the lines are secure and you can't tap them or whatever. And Jim, I believe you said, don't let me misquote you, that you don't think the government should be involved in something like that. Is that an accurate representation?
Well, we're talking about
physical security. Okay. So let me pose a question to you guys, and let me get some responses. You can yell them out, you can applaud, whatever. Who's the best bad guy these days? Hussein? Gaddafi? Is Hussein good bad guy to pick on? Bill Gates. His $40 million house has denial of service prevention built into it. Senator Exxon. You guys do hate. It's wonderful. All right, I'm going to go back to Hussein anyway. Hussein sends in what's left of his Air Force and bombs the Statue of Liberty to the bottom of New York Harbor, what should our response be? Nuke him. Is that a nuke him? Is that a big nuke or a small nuke? A major nuke. Are you? So you're saying there ought to be a military response. All right, Baghdad, the parking lot theory. I've heard that before. Yes. All right. Does everybody by applause, do they tend to agree that if Hussein takes out the Statue of Liberty, should we have a military response by a show of hands or applause? Okay. Let's say Hussein comes in and does not take out the Statue of Liberty. He takes out RFK Stadium or any ballpark in the United States. That was probably a bad example this year. With the ball players, there'd be no response. I understand. Should we, if an adversary like that comes in and takes out a non-national symbol, physically bombs us, should we then have a military response? Applause or show of hands? Yes, okay, good. I tend to agree with that. Now, let's say, instead of Hussein coming in and physically bombing something, Hussein comes in, creates a denial of service electronic attack against a major financial institution and knocks off $300 billion from the Federal Reserve and moves the money electronically someplace else through some nice sophisticated mechanism that the cyberpunks have created. Should our response be military? Nuke him for that! Should we have a military response to that kind of action? Yes. Everybody's saying yes here. All right. Is that an everybody? By applause. Military response for that. Okay. Applause for not doing a military response. Oh, okay. Sounds like it's about 50-50 to me. In the last several months, Robert Steele and I have been involved with National Defense University, and we've been talking about this exact question. What constitutes an act of war in cyberspace? The rules change. We've sat with the Air Force lawyers. Is that a contradiction in terms? Air Force lawyer? No, that's all right. Sat with them. We've sat with guys from the Pentagon, the policymakers, the White House, Congress, trying to discuss an issue like this. How do we develop a policy by which we decide what constitutes an act of war? Now, when Jim was out there prosecuting and hacker busting, 1030 was basically the tool to use. We had a response. If you sit and ask some of the military people that may be here, what is their mandate to respond to an adversary's attack upon the private sector of the United States, you're going to find the answer to be, we have no mandate. That is not our job. Despite 50% of your belief, maybe 50% in our community as well, there is no political mandate by which the United States military is to protect U.S. domestic issues. Which brings up a very fundamental question that those of us who believe this response or some policy response is necessary comes up. Is the economy of the United States of America a national security asset? Applause, yes. Applause, no. You're in the minority, you lose. So what we're saying is, in this group, the economy is a national security asset worthy of protection. Worthy of protection? Okay. Yet we as a country don't have a policy by which to defend it yet. If Citibank gets ripped off for $1 billion, we have no formal policy to respond. If 3M's formula for barnacle glue gets ripped off, there is no policy to respond. And this is where Robert Steele, with his national information strategy, I'm working on it with my national information policy, and a number of us are debating this issue because we see it ultimately denial of service against what we consider to be national security assets of the United States to be at risk through new techniques that have not conventionally been used. And that's where the denial of service issue comes in. So this get back to Robert's issue, and I'm going to close on this note, and I'll be happy to answer some questions, or if not answer them, at least respond. What about you guys? You guys have pointed out the chinks in the armor for a long time. Robert calls you assets to be cultivated and not persecuted. You are national information resources to help the national information superstructure, infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, to help it survive. You've pinged everybody, you've broken in, you're exposing the weaknesses. Okay. From the standpoint of denial of service, I'm sure a number of you can start thinking in your own mind how to create a denial of service type attack. I don't have to tell you how to do it. You're creative. But don't go out and do it. That's not what I'm trying to say here. What I'm trying to say is, if Robert's position is that you are really national security, that you're national resources, how about starting to help us with some answers? How do we work with the military, work with the private sector, work with the government, work with major corporations, and say, the denial of service events that we've already seen some bits of, some that we have not seen yet, using conventional weapons, using non-conventional weapons, using worms, whatever the techniques may be, what can we do to create a defensive infrastructure within the existing infrastructure to alleviate any future possibilities of deep pain? There are not immediate answers here. There are not immediate technical answers. There are not immediate policy answers. And a lot of what I say is viewed as very unpopular, because I'm looking 5 years down the line here. But if we look back to the early 1980s, viruses were not an epidemic. But what's happened with the curve? We go along and then we have the steep curve that came up at some asymptote in the curve, in the numbers. Same thing with quote-unquote hacking attacks. Very, very low numbers, and then it got real steep as the connectivity got there and more people got online, et cetera, et cetera. My argument is that in those other two arenas, using malicious software, viruses, and using hacking penetration techniques, we saw consistent increases when the availability was there and when the knowledge was there and was distributed. From a denial of service standpoint, do we have any reason to assume that we will not see similar types of increases? And I'm suggesting no, that there is no reason not to assume that at this point, especially if we're talking about the national security assets of the United States surviving. So I just wanted to leave you with those thoughts, something to think about as to how you could live up to Robert Steele's vision of you to help us. Help us come up with some of the answers that we all are looking for. You guys have been a wonderful audience, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if I can. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Has anybody built them? I have a picture with me of a homebrew version of one that puts out 16 megawatts of power. It weighs about 7 or 8 pounds and cost about $100 to build. The thing you need to understand about these things is that the power output is a function of time. When we talk about a 100-watt light bulb, that's 100 watts of continuous power going over and over. We call that 100% duty cycle. If I release 1 watt of power as is measured in continuous duty cycle, if I release that amount of power in 1 microsecond, I'm releasing a 1 megawatt spike. So we have an issue of frequency, distribution, noise, and time for discharge of a particular pulse. So it's fairly easy to get up to a fair amount of power fairly quickly. The military has a very active program called Directed Energy Weapons, DEW, and it's all secret stuff, so let me tell you about it. Damn phone, huh? Sorry, Mr. Clinton. In the opening minutes of the Gulf War, everybody remembers the Iraqi virus hoax? Yeah? Okay. Instead of that, what we used, really, was non-nuclear magnetic weapon-tipped Tomahawk missiles, which put out umpteen, I don't have the numbers because those are certainly classified numbers, put out megawatts, if not gigawatts, of power near the radar installations that are defending the southern border of Iraq to take down their ability to detect our FF-117s and the further cruise missiles that were going to make right turns at the Al Rashid Hotel for the benefit of CNN. But yes, the military has active work in this to use them as weapon systems. The problem that we have from our community is that every time the military ends up with something, it ends up migrating out of their domain, even though the secrecy, physical security, what have you, the information migrates down. And an awful lot of the stuff is pretty much engineering 101 oriented. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, sir. Because of an issue that I've been trying to, and I'm glad you asked the question, I've been trying to warn people about, in your community especially, people say, oh, I'm going to go play with this stuff. It sounds like a lot of fun. Are you familiar with the lady who put her poodle in the microwave? The term collateral biological damage comes to mind. Ask any radar technician now in his grave what happens when he stands in front of a 50,000-watt Klystron transmitting tube. He fries. You do not want to be near these things. You do not want to play with these things. They will cook you. They will sterilize you. They will make you wish for a cellular phone. And despite the intrigue of the simplicity with which to do it, we do not know enough in the unclassified world about all of the effects of this. If we are debating 5 milliwatt transmitters causing brain cancer, would you like to come up here and be subject to 16 megawatt pulses? Okay? Please don't play with this stuff. Please. Yes, sir. I'm only catching half of what you're saying. I'm sorry. Can you stand up and yell at me? That's better. As I hear the question, it's instead of developing military responses, why don't we develop a defensive system? The area of defending against, in this case, magnetic weapons, is moderately well known within the classified arena, and it's called hardening. And if you recall that term, you may have heard of hardened missile silos that sit in the cornfields of Nebraska. And the original intent of those was to provide umpteen feet of lead and steel and shielding within the concrete so that if one of their nukes came over, it would not destroy the electronics of our missiles before we got them off in some sort of mutual assured destruction response. The problem is that from the non-classified world, we do not fully understand all of the ramifications of this yet from a biological collateral damage standpoint or from an inexpensive, viable means for the private sector to defend itself. As Jim was saying, if they're still using passwords, you think that they're going to put up thick concrete to protect their computers? I don't think so, not yet. But I do agree that the awareness needs to be there. The reason that we talk about military responses is because as the United States' priorities shift in a post-Cold War world, we do not have active policies that come down from the government, or from the legislative branch and the executive branch into the military to define their missions. And I'm not saying that I'm right. What I am saying is that the debate needs to get wide open because suddenly in the post-Cold War world, the government and the military are not so isolated from the commercial sector's concerns. As Jim was saying again, the classified systems within the federal government, they're in pretty good shape as long as you don't have an Aldrich Ames hanging out in your neighborhood. However, the substance, the unclassified, sensitive but unclassified or unclassified systems are the support infrastructure for military, for government. If you remove those, which are basically private sector systems, the good portions of the government classified systems cease to operate as efficiently. And what we're saying is that we're all now in the same boat. Why don't we work together at it? And if it means a military response, fine. If we come up with another policy, that's fine as well. But we need to have the open discussion. Any other questions? Yes, sir. If you plug it in, if you leave it in the wall, it's a capacitive charging system. You can, it'll charge up over some period of time depending upon your charging circuits. It's a power supply with a discharge like you have in your car. So you can do it with spark gap dischargers as well. The output on the one that I've seen uses a screwdriver that gets chewed up very quickly with megawatts going through it. But it's like a spark gap inside of a car that's used to ignite the fumes of a combustion engine. Same principle. DA. Can't hear you. All right, well, you're making a distinction. I understand your point, and this is what the debate is about, diversity of opinion. When you talk about corporations versus other corporations in some sort of what that would classify as my class two information warfare model, I might take what you're saying as a little bit more, I take it more importantly and agree with it, perhaps. However, let's look at the fact that an awful lot of the spying, if you will, the class two and beginning of class three information warfare events are nation state sponsored. When we look at Germany with Project Rahab having state sponsored, officiated by Helmut Kohl himself in 1988 to initiate formal intelligence hacking against the rest of the world, the rules have changed a little bit. When the Japanese have billions of dollars pumped into intelligence operations for their own economic benefit against the United States, I think the rules change when we're talking nation-state responses. And again, if we're talking denial of service, massive denial of service attacks, not events, but attacks that are potential from adversaries of the United States, I believe the rules change. And then we're no longer talking stealing secrets from one company to another, but we have a rippling effect that if there are systemic collapses within the econo-technical infrastructure, I think that my belief is we need a different response mechanism. And so does 50% of you, too, so thank you. It is blurred. You're absolutely right. It's heavily blurred. The whole area is blurred. What is a border? What is nationalism? All of it's highly blurred, and that only exasperates the ability to come up with black and white answers. I don't believe there are black and white answers anymore, and I don't believe the answers are going to be two-dimensional anymore. I think we have to look at them from a multidimensional standpoint, and the military, because of its capabilities and look into what they call C4I, command, control, computer, and communications, for doing waging information warfare, they have some of the fundamental techniques at their disposal if we can start getting some policy think thrown at it other than conventional military think. There's a number of Air Force information warfare guys that are here, and you might find it kind of interesting to chat with them from their perspective as well. Any other questions? Yes, sir. VanEck devices. Does everybody know what a VanEck device is? No, okay. VanEck, Wim VanEck, he was a Dutch researcher in 1984, published a paper to the chagrin of the National Security Agency, telephone. And this paper basically said, computers leak. They leak information. That means like a radio transmitter that broadcasts at 50,000 watts and you can pick it up on the car or where have you, in your car radio. Computers are miniature radio transmitters that broadcast the information that they're processing. The most offensive or the leakiest or the loudest broadcast that comes out of computers is from the monitor circuitry, the video cards, the antenna that goes to it, and ultimately the monitor. The information that is broadcast out of these systems is what we call composite video information minus synchronization. means that the horizontal and vertical sync signals do not get broadcast because they're comparatively low frequency. The fundamental frequency that is broadcast is based upon the pixel dot, and you'll have a fundamental sitting between 22 and 45 megahertz. And you can tune it in on your television set. And for everybody that lived through VIC-20 and Trash 80 days, and you had it sitting on your trying to watch TV at the same time, is interference. That's video information. With a modified black and white television set, which has a nominal horizontal scan frequency of 15,750 hertz, you can pick up CGA, which is the same frequency, horizontal scans, by using the horizontal scan frequency of the TV set and a modification of that circuit using one component and synchronizing the vertical sync between 59.94 and 60 hertz. The techniques to do this have been well known. Wim Van Eck published the papers in 1984, and then Moeller in Germany published advanced papers in 1990. The NSA unfortunately classified them both, so you can't see them, but if you want them, they're on the net. And the work of Don White out of Electromagnetic Control Systems in Virginia. This is all open source information. There's nothing terribly trick about it. I do have another video on British Van Eck tempest busting in the city of London. It's been used, absolutely been used. There's been companies in Northern California that have been attacked using Japanese and Korean monitoring stations. The Koreans came to me to buy 8 sophisticated setups for it. I did not sell it to them. I turned them down. They wanted for educational purposes only, but they were going to run $300,000 a crack, so they were, I don't believe that they were for education. The National Security Agency builds vans, has special tempest vans that are used for, allegedly used for surveillance of these kinds of things. It has been said by some people that in the Ames case, they were able to get some of the information on him by using this technique of eavesdropping upon his computers at home from vans in the street. That's an allegation. I don't know if it's true, but the capability is certainly there. In general, the government feels that Van Eck radiation, the tempest radiation problem, is not as great as other problems, because when you're out there scanning the airwaves or plugging onto the power lines or the ground signals, you're kind of putting your finger up in the air praying to get some valuable information. Targeting is difficult, it's expensive, and it's time consuming. Okay? Anything else? Yes, sir. Laptops are pickable up. I have picked up laptops, very simply, same thing, because the drive circuitry is the same. Your video drive circuitry is the offending circuitry, much more so. The LCD display has very little to do with it. All right. Thank you very much. And let me give this back to Dark Tangent. You guys have been wonderful.